south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started.
Hey, you know, this show is about the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great in Latin America, right? How about including once in a while things we or I absolutely hate about Latin America, or Latin Americans? So what do I really hate or dislike? I dislike the fact that at least a third of the time when you go to a classified ad or OLX.com, that's my favorite sort of Latin Craigslist, or even those famous bulletin boards where you really get the great deals, you'll see at least a third of the time people do not put a price on what they're selling. And I absolutely hate that. I don't know about you, but I do not want to make a couple of phone calls or send a few emails to someone saying, hey, you know, you're selling a car, a boat, ab cruncher, Vegematic, whatever. What's this, a game? Am I supposed to guess how much? You dope. So that's something that really bugs me, and it bugs a lot of first world gringos. They say to me, Johnny, why don't these people put the prices down? I just don't get it. In fact, not so long ago, a Latin buddy of mine, college educated, smart in some ways, stupid in others, like most of us, I guess, he said, Johnny, I'm selling two of my guitars. If you know anyone who's interested, pass the word around. And I said, how much? And he said, well, for the Stratocaster, I think I want $300. He said, I've got it on OLX. And at that moment, we were in front of a computer, so I checked it out. And sure enough, he hadn't put a price on it. Duh. And this from a so-called educated Latin. Naturally, this got me going, and I went through the same discussion with him. Why do you guys put these things on OLX and in the newspaper and you don't put a damn price on it? You know you want $300 for it. Put down $300. He just gave me a look like I was making way too big a deal out of it. Maybe I was. And I said, why? Just tell me why do people do that? It's aggravating and a real time waster, you know. By the way, where that's most prevalent is in real estate ads. For sale, for rent, doesn't make a difference. I'd say half of them don't have a price. I mean, come on, you got to have a benchmark. You have to have a place to start anyway. I mean, that's a basic rule of negotiation, right? That's when my Latin buddy said, Johnny, you just don't understand the Latin mentality. I said, oh, I think I do. I've been down here a long, long time. He said, nope, I beg to differ. He said, well, Johnny, consider this. When you get that phone call, when you hear their accent, how they speak, you can instantly qualify a person, especially if it's an item that's kind of expensive, let's say over $50 or $100. For example, if on that phone call you hear a lot of street noise in the background, you know he or she is calling from a payphone. You can even tell it's a payphone by the caller ID. Then your first thought, at least my first thought is, he said, that they don't really have a pot to pee in. If they use a payphone, they certainly live in a bad neighborhood, have some bad habits, and maybe even some bad friends. Then he said, in my case, with selling guitars, I don't want that guy coming over to my neighborhood, walking in my house, checking out all my stuff. Then he said, you know, a lot of deals are done in parking lots. People don't want prospective buyers they don't know from Adam come into their subdivisions, neighborhoods, or houses. Then he said, probably in this case, I'll drive to the nearest Walmart or McDonald's parking lot, have my guitars in the back seat, and whoever wants to come and look at them, they'll meet me there and we'll do the deal or not. By the way, he said, when someone phones you up, a prospective buyer, it's a good idea to ask them what town they live in or what zone in the city. That's an easy way to qualify a person too, because you know, certain zones and subdivisions are ghettos and some are high-end, etc. Now, that's not to say every single person who uses a payphone is a broke-ass scumbag. After all, he or she might live in a scummy part of town, but they have the cash, the money to buy whatever you're selling, because they don't blow it all every month on a cell phone contract. They use the payphone, which is infinitely cheaper. Even so, he said, I'm not going to invite a guy like that into my house, not into my gated, guarded community. Then he said something that surprised me. He said, I don't get you gringos. You're so trusting. You invite anyone and anybody into your house. He said, people you meet at a mall or a coffee shop, just because they speak English, all of a sudden they're your friends and you're having them at your house for Sunday dinner. I don't get that. Then I slipped him a zinger and said, you know what? I don't get you Latins either. You guys with a little money spend every last cent on designer clothes, bling, and nice cars. Then you hire bodyguards and you tell everyone it's for your protection, but that's a joke because they're the first one that are going to rip you off. Nope, I don't get it. Hey, I could have hit him a lot harder than that. but we agreed to disagree. Anyway, he said, Johnny, you know, when you sell something in the paper or on OLX.com, it's almost never just one person who'll show up and look at the thing. They'll come with their buddies, their mothers, sisters, uncles, dogs. Let's just say when you sell something, you don't want it to be an open house for every Tom, Dick, and Julio. However, he said, you're kind of stuck if you're selling something like, for example, a washing machine or a refrigerator. You just can't throw that in the back of your trunk and haul it to the nearest Walmart or McDonald's parking lot to make a deal. Then he said, you know, Johnny, I bet half of the used car deals down here are made in McDonald's and Burger King parking lots. That really is a safe way to meet prospective buyers. It's easy to size them up, see if they have the dough or they're just time wasters or tire kickers. For example, if you're selling a car, a decent car anyway, and it's something that might cost $4,000 or more, chances are the prospective buyer is going to be coming from work. They'll be dressed rather nicely, coming in a car, maybe a friend's car. So the tip here, beware if they're coming on a chicken bus. That tells a lot about a person and if they actually have the money to pull off such a deal. By the way, I've sold more than a few cars here in Latin America myself, and sometimes the people that show up don't have near enough money to buy your car, and you don't find that out until after you've gone through your whole spiel. You hear things like this. Look, mister, you want $4,000 for the car, but I've only got $2,500 right now. Will you take it? Duh. And I've heard this one, too. Listen, mister, I've got $2,500, but I've got a motorcycle to sell, too. Will you take a trade? Double duh. Then why'd you come, you idiot? Sell the motorcycle and come back with the cash. Sheesh. Yep, another couple hours wasted because you gotta get the car ready, drive to the nearest McDonald's, whatever, hang out and wait for the guy. You know the drill. This is Latin America, you know. Mañana time, everywhere. And all of us gringos who've been down here for a while, we've moved from place to place, and therefore we've sold things on the internet and in classified ads and such. And that means each of us has a number of frustrating, time-wasting buy-and-sell stories we could tell. That's why you really have to try to pre-qualify these guys. For example, if you're in a Walmart parking lot meeting someone you've never met before, if you're the buyer and it's a car, a motorcycle, or something big, you're never going to hand the cash or give a check right there in the parking lot. If you're the seller, and we're talking about a car or a motorcycle or something big, you're not going to take cash or check either, not in the parking lot. You're going to do that deal in your lawyer's office. That's the only way you should do it. Now, when talking about buying or selling small stuff like a guitar or propane tank, weed whacker, or even a pet, you can do the deal in a parking lot and it'll always be for cash. But for bigger stuff like cars and motorcycles, it only stands to reason that no matter what country you're in, you shouldn't be carrying large amounts of cash on you, meeting someone you don't know in a parking lot. Again, save that transaction for your lawyer's office. And if it's a big amount of cash you're dealing with, he, your lawyer, will actually go down to the buyer or seller's bank and do the deal right there with you. So a public parking lot is very good for inspecting a car, even driving it around a bit. After that, if you come to an agreement, head to your lawyer's office. But back to my original gripe, when people list things for sale and don't put the price. So my Latin buddy's kind of weak argument, if you ask me, is that he could size up a person on the phone if they're legit or not, and they can actually afford what he's got to sell and should he even bother meeting them in a Costco parking lot. By the way, this Latin musician buddy of mine, hate to say this, but he's one of those entitled children of the rich, helicopter schools and all that, extreme gringo wannabe, nice guy, but doesn't know what end of a screwdriver to hold. In our little discussion about buying and selling things, he told me he has two brothers in Costa Rica. And he laughed when he said this. There's two prices for everything in Costa Rica, the gringo price and the local Latin price. So many people purposely don't put a price on things they sell or are going to rent. And when someone phones up after seeing an ad, let's say for an apartment rental, the Latin proprietario, that would be the landlord or seller, can instantly tell a local Latin from a gringo. Same thing when walking through one of those big vegetable and fruit markets. Gringo prices can often be twice what the Latins are paying for the same thing. So in Costa Rica and many other gringoized areas, like parts of Mexico and Panama, Medellin, Colombia, etc., same thing. Which is why if you're doing any kind of substantial deal at all, like car, house, boat, jet ski, whatever, and you're the prospective buyer, you should have a native Latin person do the deal for you, preferably when you're not there. Because especially when you're on the gringo tourist trail, Latin sellers know that gringos don't come from a culture of bargaining and haggling. So when they see a gringo, they'll highball it. As one Latina seller in the big market once told me, gringos are extraordinarily happy if she drops her price 10 or 15%. And for Latin customers, she says, 10 or 15% off makes the gringos happy, but for Latins, that's when the serious haggling starts. Oh, and speaking of buying and selling things, this always cracks me up. At least half of the ads on OLX or in the classified newspaper ads or bulletin boards, whatever, they often have this statement in Spanish. They're always in Spanish. It says, solo interesados, interested parties only. Well, talk about redundancies, huh? Yeah, like I'm phoning you up to ask about your apartment, but I'm not interested. I just like to go through the classifieds and phone people up. That's my hobby. Duh. Oh, by the way, occasionally we talk about chicken buses here. The belching, sometimes dangerous, ubiquitous iron horse of Latin America. And no matter how many times I warn gringos against riding them, I still see the occasional straggly-ass American or European backpacker getting on and off those things, especially at immigration land borders. Plenty of belching chicken buses rolling in there. And there's two things you can count on. They're always overloaded, way beyond their capacity. And no matter how fast you're driving down the road, if they get a chance, they'll pass you, even on a curve. So then, why do chicken buses remain the perennial favorite of backpackers everywhere? Well, let me tell you, after about 3 minutes, you get over the novelty and quaintness effect. That's for sure. I mean, why do you think they call them chicken buses? Because sometimes you'll be sitting next to one, or worse yet, a whiny, drooling kid with a drippy popsicle, or perhaps another revolting animal species. So, after those first fun few chicken bus moments on a hard bench seat, it's all about saving a buck, because it's only slightly more expensive than walking. Anyway, not so long ago, I was driving out in the boonies with two gringos in the car with me, and we came upon a very strange sight. In a little town square, there were three identical chicken buses in all their gaudy chrome and neon glory. You know, they really decked those things out. By the way, they're always named after a saint, a wife, a girlfriend, or Jesus. Anyway, these three buses were decked out with hundreds of colorful balloons. And right away, the two gringos in the car said, "Stop, Jenny, stop," and they got out, took pictures. I told them, "Today's a special day. Those buses have been rented for a 15 años party." Then I explained, when you're middle class or lower middle class and you live way out in the boonies, when a young girl in the family turns 15, that's 15 años, the family always throws a party, sometimes bigger than a wedding. They rent a hall, import a disco, the girl has a formal gown and all that. And since it's a huge event, sometimes there's 50, 100, even 200 people there, and they'll bus in the family members from adjacent towns. Now, if we're talking about middle or lower middle class families, they're always cash poor. So the girl's mom and dad will be saving up for years sometimes to pull off a bigger and better 15 años party than the other relatives or the family next door. Believe it or not, in the past year or so, banks are even offering financing for 15 años parties. So, like a mortgage, a family could be on the hook to a bank for years. By the way, just lately, Easy Credit's been available all throughout Latin America, which is why there's been a huge, unprecedented number of cars being sold in Latin America. So, Latin America's got a credit/finance bubble that's well underway, much like the one you guys went through back in 2007 and 2008. You can see for yourself by the advertising, the signs, the billboards on the highway and such, offering no money down for houses, land, and cars. So there's a huge bubble here in Latin America, and since they've never experienced one before, they don't even know they're in one. In fact, just this morning I passed a Volkswagen and a Volvo dealership, and both of them had signs outside saying, no money down, zero enganche. Enganche is Spanish for down payment, so zero or no enganche means zero down payment. Okay, we were talking about bank financing and going into debt with a mortgage for your daughter's 15 años party. Yeah, I'm sure that four-hour fiesta makes those years of monthly payments all worthwhile. Anyway, traditionally, when a middle or lower middle class family out in the boonies anticipates that famous 15 años or 15-year-old party, they'll save money, borrow some from friends and family, and even get a mortgage. And they'll invite all their relatives living in the nearby or not so nearby big Latin cities. And as part of the 15 años tradition, they'll rent 1, 2, 3, 5, even 10 chicken buses, and they'll deck them out with hundreds of colorful balloons. They'll motor to the big city, sometimes even fly, because oftentimes the drivers are drunk. They'll stop at a collection point, pick up all the relatives and such, drive them to that rented hall, and the fiesta will begin. So take note that wherever you are in Latin America, if you see 1, 2, 3, or even 10 chicken buses decked out in balloons, it's 15 años day for some lucky Latina 15-year-old. Now on that subject of the poor and middle class living way out in the boonies, or even in the congested kind of scruffy areas of any big Latin city, in places you and I would never think to work, play, or live in. If you're driving through, you'll always come across one, two, three, or even a half dozen pretty nice houses, which you might call solid middle-class first-world houses in a dirty, scruffy neighborhood. They look out of place, way too good for the neighborhood, so they do grab your attention. And for newbie green gringos who see that for the first time, they're thinking, man, that must be the richest guy in the neighborhood. He owns some kind of business in town. Maybe he's even an narco, but in any event, he or that family is living better than everyone else in the neighborhood. Then, inevitably, you're thinking, if a guy's got money, why in the hell would he ever live in a neighborhood like that? Well, most cases, the answer is he's not rich. He's not an important businessman in town. He's not even a narco. If you were to knock on the door of that house and say hi to the family, you'd find a single woman with a couple of kids. Maybe she's got a brother, sister, mother, father living there too. It is a big house, you know, much bigger than any of the other ones in the neighborhood. For sure, she's got a live-in maid. So where's Dad? Where's Poppy, the head of the house? Well, turns out in many cases, he's not living there at all. He's living up in the United States and he's been there for years. He slipped in as an illegal alien long time ago. Establishes himself in some kind of job, who knows what, and true to the family spirit, sends back remises every month. So that family is living high off the hog. And Latins, well, being Latins, have to show off. They just love to one-up the neighbors whenever they can. Of course, there's quite a few gringos like that too, but generally that seems to be a defect of the young up in the States, and most of us hopefully grow out of that. But for Latins, if anything, it gets worse with age in all socioeconomic classes, which is why you'll see in all poor, low-class, middle-class, and dumpy neighborhoods a couple of nice, new, seemingly first-world houses mixed in, if not right next door, back-to-back with tin-roofed shacks and other structures that wouldn't pass code up in the States if they were garages. So why am I bringing this up when it was mentioned on a past show quite a while ago? Because something rather nasty has happened since then. Now, you know I mentioned there are places I recommend gringos and expats to live in, places I say you should never step foot in. Those are the places where the extortions and gangs and all the nasty, violent things occur that you hear about in the first world news. So the rule is simple. Stay out of the low-class, scruffy, junky neighborhoods. And us gringos and expats who live down here, we know where those places are. That said, since lower and middle class Latin families who receive remises are so insistent on demonstrating their wealth and their good fortune to their neighbors, anyone with a half a brain driving through such a neighborhood can tell in a second who's got the dough, who's getting the remises. And now, just in the last year or so, a new extortion game has appeared throughout Latin America. Since the bad guys we're always hearing about live in those crappy neighborhoods, it was just a matter of time before they figured out the guy with the nicest house had money coming in from the States, and now they're pulling a new kind of extortion game. In fact, you're starting to see it on the nightly news quite a bit. Nope, not your nightly news up in Seattle or Cleveland. I'm talking about the local 6 o'clock news here in Latin America. For example, just saw a report last night. Get this. And this is being repeated over and over now in Latin America. Last night, a reporter was in a very crappy neighborhood, standing outside a gigantic first-world-style house, like a nugget of gold popping out of a sea of turds. The reporter was interviewing the lady of the house, obviously uneducated, lower class, but definitely with money. She had obviously just come from the beauty parlor, real gold chains, bling, and an iPhone. And with a tear in her eye, she was telling the story of how a couple months earlier she received an extortion note. She was approached by a tough-looking guy who said if she didn't pay $100,000 U.S., they were going to kidnap her 10-year-old kid. Of course, they didn't ask for the local funny money. They asked for U.S. funny money because remises come in dollars. Well, she got in contact with her husband up in the States, you know, the guy who was sending the remises. He said, no way. No one's got that kind of money. But not to worry, because he was going to have his two brothers, also living in that town, move into the house, and that would be kind of protection for the whole family. All right, so a month later, the kid got kidnapped. At that point, she called the cops, explained the whole thing to them, admitted she had little control of her kid, who'd go out and play with his buddies at all hours. Meanwhile, up in States, her husband, who'd been there around 10 years already, he'd scraped together 10 grand, sent it to his wife. The extortionist took it, said they wanted the rest within 2 weeks or they were going to kill the kid. 2 weeks went by, no money, and they really did kill the kid. So the husband up in the States, all shook up, slipped back into Latin America, went to the funeral. The local TV station had an interview with him, too, and wouldn't you know it, he's got an I Love New York t-shirt on, a Yankee baseball hat, a ton of gold chains, and Ray-Ban sunglasses. And in the interview, yes, he was sad and remorseful, but he just had to throw in a few English slang words. Just a classless guy, once again, trying to impress the neighbors. And I'm sure it never crossed his mind or anyone else's there the reason why they were singled out for that extortion and ultimate kidnapping and death. I mean, really, more than once this wannabe living in New York proved himself to be a clueless, uneducated idiot. Now, later on in the piece, the reporter went to the cemetery. Even at the cemetery, it was all about this family demonstrating to their friends and neighbors that they'd made it. They were much better off than everyone else. Turns out New York Daddy bought the biggest, gaudiest, and tallest mausoleum in the whole cemetery with a sculpted facsimile of the kid's face right in the tombstone. So just as their house was the biggest, gaudiest thing in the neighborhood, so was the kid's tombstone, the biggest, most out-of-place mausoleum in the whole cemetery. Now, being a part-time cynic, I was thinking, what a bunch of idiots. They were asking for trouble. Not only were they setting themselves up for whatever bad guys there were in the community, they surely had some jealous and pissed off neighbors who certainly didn't wish them well. Then Daddy, with his big ego and his pumped up first world fantasies, comes back for the funeral, tries to play the conquering hero again, and just doesn't get it. Why does the drive to show off supersede all other considerations? That's why most Latins watching that broadcast got a completely different message. They're thinking, wow, if I could just get to the United States, I'd have the sueño americano. I could send back remises and live happily ever after. Kinda. Now, if there's one thing I've learned about Latins, especially the poorer ones, they're fatalists, and when something good, bad, ugly, or even great happens, they always say, es en los manos de Dios. It was in God's hands. He did it. That way, when something really bad happens, Latins don't have to necessarily shoulder all the blame. They can shift it to the mystical realm. Which brings to mind my favorite Benjamin Franklin story. Nope, this has nothing to do with $100 bills. It has everything to do with when he was a young adult and playing around with electricity. Franklin was quite an inventor. One of his inventions was the lightning rod, and he demonstrated it to many scientific societies, including the many prestigious ones in Europe. He proved, without a doubt, that if you put one of these lightning rods on a tall building like a barn and ran a wire from it to earth ground, if a building so equipped got hit by lightning, the lightning would be harmlessly directed toward ground. In fact, one of the greatest dangers in the colonial times was fire from lightning hitting a tall structure. Because you see, lightning always tends to hit the highest point, therefore the tallest buildings. Anyway, Benjamin Franklin patented his lightning rod. Then in time, businesses and farmers who had large, vulnerable wooden barns started purchasing his lightning rods in record numbers. Turned out, most everyone with a tall building got into the act except the churches. They came out on the pulpit and in the newspaper saying lightning was God's tool, the staff of God, and man had no business fooling with it. Meaning, of course, if your barn or your house or your building got hit by lightning and it burned down, or worse yet, if you or your family member got hit by lightning, it was due to the will or the punishment of God himself. Meanwhile, a few years after Franklin invented the lightning rod and all the tall buildings around adapted it, except the churches, the only buildings that got hit by lightning and burned down were, guess what? Churches! Then suddenly the pastors on the pulpits and in the press became very silent about man fooling with the staff of God. Soon enough, lightning rods started appearing on every church in the nation. In the world, in fact. All right, taking a left turn now. Remember last week we were talking about how a new law is being forced through the Senate now? They call it a financial crimes and anti-money laundering law. Yeah, right. Well, its real purpose is for the government to find out where all your assets are, if you've got cryptocurrencies, how much, etc. Well, at the same time, airports have new rules about passengers coming from foreign countries and landing in U.S. airports. So now they're saying when flying from a foreign country to the U.S., you should plan on getting to the airport 1 to 2 hours earlier than normal. Why? Because they'll be inspecting all your electronic equipment, and you better have it all charged up. And if they can't open your device because your battery is low, you won't be traveling with it. They'll keep it, or who knows what they'll do with it. So with that new edict coming just a day or two ago, I'm already getting emails from people complaining. Listen to this one. This comes from one of our expat insider alumnus, Kelsey. And I'll paraphrase this a bit. Yes, if you're in a foreign country, they now tell you you have to be at the airport 4 hours before your scheduled departure. So, my wife and I got up at 2:30 a.m. Saturday morning to be at the airport by 3 a.m. for a 7 a.m. flight. Also, we couldn't check in online. All passengers had to check in at the airport in person, so there were massive lines. The Delta ticket agents, however, did not show up till 4:15, and then they turned on the self-check-in kiosk right after that, so we could have had an extra hour and a half of sleep. Yep, Johnny, they're doing everything they can to make travel suck. Oh, but it gets worse. I wasn't paying attention after going through customs in Atlanta once I landed in the U.S. And guess what? I took one step across the wrong doorway threshold. I stepped toward the ground transportation doorway to the right instead of connecting flights to the left. Then, three TSA employees rushed me, and when I turned around, with one foot on the threshold and one on the other, they made us exit the concourse and check in upstairs as if we were just coming in and arriving through the parking lot the first time. They made us recheck our bags and go through security again with the Atlanta people. Just for taking one effing step to the left instead of the right. Again, the U.S. is doing everything they can to make traveling to a foreign country and back suck. Well, thanks for that, Kelsey. And I know you've got your own plan B well in hand. And for all of you who haven't got a plan B yet or are just thinking about it, I do plan on having another expat insider seminar again in Central America, mostly way off the gringo tourist trail. It'll start Saturday, January 6, 2018. Through Thursday, January 11, 2018. If you're interested in getting in on the early bird list, that'll mean some discounts, of course. Send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. By the way, if you can't make it to one of my seminars and you haven't got boots on the ground yet, there's no better way to get organized than to take my Expat Insider course. Check it out and get your special introductory freebie from me by going to expatplanb.com. People are saying they just can't believe the quantity and quality of the info they get in that package. And finally, since everyone's plans are a bit different, if you want me to help you hash things out in your own plan B with a one-on-one Skype or phone consult, first go to www.thenewexpat.com to download my phone consult questionnaire. And even if we don't end up talking personally, you'll get a lot of good ideas just by reviewing it. So go to www.thenewexpat.com, download that questionnaire, it's free.
South of the border.
This is the Expat Files, living in Latin America. If you want me to help you out with your own plan B, just schedule a one-on-one consult. Send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And if you want to learn how to move forward with your own plan B from right up there in the States, go to www.expatplanb.com and check out my three videos. See ya. Nos vemos.